From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Reagan Edelman. Yellowstone National Park consists of nearly 3,500 square miles of wilderness recreation land across Wyoming and spread into parts of Montana and Idaho. It's a must-see for ecotourists and hosts millions of visitors each year for a myriad of reasons. Sitting on top of a volcanic hotspot, the national park is home to canyons, geysers, lush forests, and hot springs. And the park is also known for the hundreds of animal species that call it home, including bison, elk, deer, bears, and wolves, among others. But there's been an imbalance in how humans viewed these animals and in how we decided to rank their worth. Wolves were once naturally abundant in Yellowstone, but starting in the 1870s, they fell prey to humans who hunted them until their numbers were non-existent. The mission was to protect big game, like the bison and the elk, but the perceived threat that wolves were to these species wasn't really correct. And Dan McNulty suggests that their very physiology doesn't allow for them to wipe out populations. Dr. Dan McNulty is a professor in the Department of Wildland Resources at Utah State University. His research centers on animal behavior, population biology, and community ecology. And much of his research has centered around Yellowstone National Park and understanding the ecological consequences of the wolf reintroduction back in 1995. Dan, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Dan, today I want to start by going back in time. Back in time to the early 1900s, where wolves once flourished in Yellowstone National Park, there was this quick and sudden drop in their population due to overhunting. What happened?
The reason why they hunted the wolves and actually poisoned them was to protect game animals, primarily. It was a time in which predators were seen as being an ecological menace to big game populations. And so wolves alongside cougars and to some extent bears were eliminated or greatly reduced, at least in the case of mountain lions and grizzly bears, and in the case of wolves, completely eliminated. It was all driven by a desire to boost big game populations. Park records, the historical record is very clear that Park Service hired guns to shoot wolves, to poison them, to remove pups from dens, etc. So this was actually a formal, federally endorsed public policy that the Park Service, that was part of what the Park Service did, was eliminate predators. And this was during the early 20th century. And they were motivated by a desire to enhance big game. So it was during an era in which animals, sort of value of animals, was sort of distributed unevenly across these different species.
So when did this start to shift? There's still an uneven view. Wolves don't have a stable position in society. Humans still tend to value animals that serve us a little better, like game, a little bit more. But when did there start to be a shift here? When did we start realizing that there is importance to predators? Even if we feel like they're nuisances, even if they bother us, they're still important.
Big game are considered more valuable than predators. It's only later with Aldo Leopold and his Sand County Almanac, where he basically provides an explanation for the ecological value of predators. And he was an important voice because he was actually one of these agents of the federal government that was employed to kill wolves, not in Yellowstone, but elsewhere in the American West. He was involved in the southwestern United States. And so he had a change of heart that was expressed in this famous chapter in that book called Thinking Like a Mountain.
And part of that ecological value was this idea that wolves actually help the overall health of certain populations. And it's really interesting to me that we found wolves to be threats to big game, because they're really not. They're opportunistic hunters that are much more likely to go for weaker prey, not the biggest, strongest elk in the park.
Yes. So wolves are physically incapable of killing any prey animal that they want. It starts with the fact that they're relatively small bodied relative to, say, like an African lion or a tiger or a polar bear. So it's not easy for them to simply, you know, physically overcome a prey animal like an elk or certainly like a bison that is much bigger than they are. So they have, they're at a size disadvantage. In addition, the physical morphology of wolves in terms of their jaw morphology, their limb morphology, they can't rotate their elbows like a African lion can or a mountain lion can, which means that they can't grapple their prey. If you threw your dog, you know, a ball or a wolf a ball, they're not going to be able to catch it with their paws. They catch it with their mouth. And so all it has are its teeth. That's its only weapon, or its teeth. And those teeth themselves aren't perfectly adapted to a performing a killing bite. And this has to do with the shape of the skull. They have a relatively long skull, which basically their bite force is less.
And so, Dan, how does this tool set for killing, this limited tool set, adjust their target prey?
From a wolf point of view, particularly like an adult male bison, these things are huge, you know, weighing a ton, extremely dangerous. They kick, they stomp, they horn, they'll throw wolves into the air. We've had wolves killed by bison. And the vulnerable point on a big adult male bison is its backside. But there aren't a lot of vital organs in its backside. And so this limited tool set that they have for killing leads to very selective hunting. So they rarely go after those big adult male bison. They're actually targeting the more vulnerable younger calves. They're also targeting the really old adult male bison. They're not as fast. They're not as strong. They don't evade wolves as efficiently as a younger individual could. So wolf predation, by and large, is highly age selective. They have this limited tool set for killing. And what that means is it puts them at risk of injury and death. You know, they can't get in there and put on a quick bite. And the longer the struggle goes on, the greater the probability that they're going to get injured or killed in the process. And it isn't just bison that are dangerous. It's elk, even deer. Like when I was a technician, we followed up on a radio-collared wolf that had died in the forest. And we paddled out to a lake and got across the lake and tracked down this wolf's carcass. And it had been out there for quite a while, it turned out. And we found its skull. And there was a perfectly shaped, like, cloven deer hoof. Into sort of imprinted right between the eyes of the wolf's skull. And clearly it had taken a shot right to the head by a deer. And so even a deer, which is a white-tailed deer, which is relatively small compared to an elk or a bison, even they can be dangerous.
So let's fast forward a little bit. The last pack in Yellowstone was killed in the early 1920s. And this is something that caused a cascade of consequences. But then in 1995, this decision was made, and over the next 2 years, there were about 40, I believe, wolves that were reintroduced to the park. And Dan, you were there, right? You were working with these wolves. Was that something you were planning on? Did you go into this with the intention of working with the reintroduced wolves?
That is correct. I started as a field technician in November 1995. Which was the first winter that wolves had been released and roaming around, free ranging in Yellowstone. I would say it was being in the right place at the right time. I was certainly interested in wildlife ecology, and my primary interest was just simply learning about wildlife firsthand. The broader study that I was a part of and that I was supporting was definitely geared towards understanding what the impact of wolves was on the elk population. And so my assignment, along with other technicians, was to radio track the wolves that had been released. They all had radio collars, and we were following them around in northern Yellowstone, locating them and seeing whether or not they had made a kill. And if they had made a kill, we would wait patiently for them to leave, and we'd go in to the kill site, identify the species, the age, the sex, whether it was malnourished by looking at things like its bone marrow, any other signs of abnormalities, skeletal abnormalities, and that sort of thing. And so we were looking at patterns of prey use, and then also we were looking at the frequency of killing. So how often were wolves taking elk? Because we wanted to measure the what's referred to as kill rate as a way to estimate the proportion of the population that was being removed by wolves. We wanted to ultimately measure the predatory impact.
And what did you and the Yellowstone Wolf Project team as a whole find?
One of the great discoveries that myself and others made was that we could watch wolves in plain daylight from the road. Not only could we watch them feed on what they killed, but we could actually watch them in the course of killing. We could actually watch these behavioral interactions with prey, primarily elk. And not only were we watching just one or two of these interactions, we were watching, 10, 20, 30, so much so that we were developing a pretty deep data set on the factors involved in the predatory behavior of wolves and what drove their success. And we were able to measure the effects of group size, wolf group size, on hunting success to explore and to understand questions related to cooperative hunting, that sort of thing. You know, up until that time, the only place where you could watch wolves like that would be on Ellesmere Island up in northern Canada, up in the High Arctic, or you could watch them from aircraft. Dave Meach, Rolf Peterson, they studied wolves on Isle Royale and Lake Superior, and they had pioneered watching wolves, but from aircraft, because Isle Royale is flat, forested environment. It's difficult to watch them from the ground. But the aircraft observations were limited because you could only circle around an aircraft for so long until you needed to land and refuel. And so what Yellowstone provided was this continuous view of wolves. We'd be watching them for hours on end continuously, sometimes the entire day from basically sun up to sundown. And so it just gave us this extraordinary perspective and insight into sort of the daily behavioral patterns of wolves. And it wasn't just wolves hunting that we were observing. It was also their interactions within the pack, between packs. We learned about how pack size affects interactions between packs and how territoriality is a really important component, not only the social behavior of wolves, but also the general ecology of wolves and how it influences their interactions with other species.
Something that you've made a point of in the past and something that you've worked on is this idea that Yellowstone is not what would be called a quote-unquote true wilderness. This is in part due to the tourism. There are millions of people flocking there to hike or to view wildlife, among other things. But it's also partially because of the transboundary movement of wildlife, meaning wildlife isn't properly encompassed by the boundaries of Yellowstone National Park.
Right. So the box, basically, that we call Yellowstone National Park, so the boundary that surrounds it, doesn't reflect any real ecological boundary. It's an administrative boundary. It's a political boundary that wildlife are unaware of in terms of their annual movements. When the animals leave the park, they are under the jurisdiction of the respective states, Montana, Idaho, or Wyoming, if these are animals that are not listed as federally threatened and endangered species. So, for example, an elk from the northern Yellowstone elk population. It's a species that is not threatened or endangered. And therefore, when it crosses from the park into Montana, it crosses from being under the authority of the National Park Service in Yellowstone to being under the authority of Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks in Montana. And the management goals of those different agencies are quite different. In Yellowstone, it's preservation. Outside the park, it would be more conservation, and there's an emphasis on hunting, sustainable yield, that sort of thing. And so it's not just elk, it's other species, wolves. They're also being hunted outside the park, both in Montana as well as in Idaho and in Wyoming. In the case of elk, in those years, back in the mid to late 90s, when I was a technician, thousands of elk from the northern Yellowstone elk population were being harvested by hunters when they crossed that boundary. And that harvest contributed substantially to the decline of the northern Yellowstone elk population. This is well documented in the scientific literature. For the better part of 8 years following the initial wolf reintroduction, hunters outside of northern Yellowstone in Montana were taking a larger proportion of the elk population than were wolves. And so they had their thumb on the scale of elk population dynamics much more than the wolf population did. And so that transboundary movement contributed substantially to the dynamics of the elk population. And so what happens outside the park has a substantial influence on what happens inside the park in terms of human effects.
So when they're inside the park, it's a protected land, correct? So the national park can almost act as a first line of defense in protecting animals like wolves, but if they leave the park, if there's any migration across this human-made border, it's an idea rather than a physical barrier, so they move. The populations are in danger of hunting again. Is that correct?
That is correct. And in the case of wolves, it isn't migration. It's simply the fact that their territories, some portion of them kind of overlap the boundary, and maybe 95% of their territory, and therefore 95% of the time, actually is inside the park. That 5%, is outside the park. And when they drift outside the park, those wolves are exposed to hunters in a region around Gardner, Montana. And this is outside the park. It's in that region that wolves are actually highly vulnerable. It's very open country. You can spot a wolf from a long ways off. And then also, you're dealing with wolf packs who, because they spend most of their time inside the park, they don't associate humans as a threat. These are wolves that are being watched inside the park. And so, when they cross over, even if it's for a few hours, they don't distinguish between humans with guns and humans without guns. And so as a result, they're a bit naive to hunters and at high risk.
And this is not just an environmental issue either. I mean, that's the heart of it, right? The wolves are a keystone species. There's the science discussing trophic cascade as a reason for protecting them. But there's also, in the case of Yellowstone, this economic pressure to preserve wolves because they bring in a lot of tourists, right? And then there's this overarching issue with wildlife management and state boundaries as well that you've mentioned. Talk a little bit about that.
These are wolves that spend most of their time in Yellowstone National Park being observed by thousands, tens of thousands of people every year. So they have a real role to play in terms of visitor use, visitor enjoyment. The protection of those wolves is necessary for the Yellowstone National Park to fulfill its mission for protection, preservation, education. And moreover, these wolves are in packs that are counted by the state of Wyoming towards their minimum population requirement that's mandated by the Endangered Species Act. And so Wyoming is actually counting those packs as belonging to the Wyoming wolf population. And yet they're being shot by Montana hunters just outside the boundary. And that's problematic because the whole rationale for hunting wolves outside Northern Yellowstone in Montana, according to Montana statute, is to reduce the Montana wolf population. But these hunters aren't reducing the Montana wolf population if the state of Wyoming is counting them as mortalities against the Wyoming wolf population. So from a management standpoint, it makes no sense. So I think there are just a number of reasons why there should be no hunting in that region of wolves. So I've yet to hear a coherent argument.
What are the arguments, just out of curiosity, what are the arguments that you usually do hear?
One might say, well, you need to eliminate wolves in this area to increase the elk population. Well, it turns out that the Northern Yellowstone elk population is at or above objective, as established by Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. One might say, well, you have to reduce wolves in this area to reduce predation on livestock. Well, there is no predation on livestock in this region. That's not an issue. In fact, you know, people are making a lot of money, businesses are, off of wolf-related tourism. And removing these wolves is essentially removing a valuable asset, economic asset, from this community.
So in your time studying wolves and in your research revolving around Yellowstone, have you seen any steps taken in the right direction to protect wolves? Is there any legislation that's been made that's pushing towards what you're hoping for, or anything that you've seen that just, like, that's a step, that's good? Or is it something that you're just constantly hoping for and hasn't even begun to come to fruition yet?
Well, there are a number of efforts from a variety of different stakeholders, Park Service, various local NGOs, members of the business community in Gardner, Montana, and elsewhere in Park County. These are stakeholders that are lobbying Montana Fish and Wildlife Commission to reduce the hunting pressure. There's an amendment presently before the commission that's actually was advanced by the Region 3 commissioner to essentially subdivide this area that we're calling 313 into two separate units and to distribute into, instead of just taking six wolves across this very large region, it would be three wolves in each of two smaller regions. And so that would reduce the hunting pressure, because most of the wolves that are killed come from the area immediately around Gardner, Montana. And so these lobbying efforts want to distribute that pressure. So that's a step in the right direction. But what's really important to understand is that this process by which the commission makes decisions regarding management of wolves and hunting of wolves in this region, that's subject to change on an annual basis. They might vote on that amendment and split it up into two regions for distributing the hunting pressure. But next year, they might go back and reinstate this larger region. They might increase the quota. I mean, it's highly variable from one year to the next. That's why we ended up a couple of years ago having a record number of wolves removed from this area. You know, upwards of 20 or more were killed, because the legislature in Montana passed a law saying, you know, we have to reduce the Montana wolf population. And then the commission said, okay, well, we're going to remove quotas from this region. We're going to take as many wolves as we can. So it's not a process by which permanent protection is a given by any means. It's, if anything, it's a sort of a temporary reprieve. And I think more permanent protections, I think, are justified given the tremendous value of Yellowstone wolves economically, from a research standpoint, from an educational standpoint.
That's Dan McNulty. Dan is a professor in the Department of Wildland Resources at Utah State University, and his research focuses on animal behavior, population biology, and community ecology. Dan, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio, and if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us every Thursday morning at 10:30 a.m. If you miss us, then you can listen to every episode of Undisciplined wherever you get your podcasts. Our program is supported by the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University and from listeners like you. You can support our work at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. I'm your producer, Reagan Edelman, and our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Tissot. Thank you for listening. Now go have big ideas.